brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. Last episode, we had the revisiting the 9/11 memorial, which I did with Brandon Webb. So I thought it was a really powerful episode, but we're actually recording this as well on September 11th. Sean Parnell is in studio. I definitely want to talk about Man of War, the second book that you've written, but the first novel. You know, the first book was about some guys that you served. But I think before we even get into that, just the fact that we're in New York City on the 17th anniversary of 9/11, like, I think it'd be interesting just to hear about, like, where you were and for you guys, it really changed the course of your life, so.
Yeah, you want me to start?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so I was a sophomore in college, you know. I think back in the day, I was a elementary education major. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I mean, the only thing I was really focused on was, like, trying to figure out what beer I was going to get my hands on that night, you know, because I was, like, still under 21. And then I remember waking up, you know, on a beautiful September morning, you know, laying flat on my back in this rundown college apartment with these beer cans all around me. And I sat up and, like, the world is spinning, had the hangover of a lifetime. And I remember staggering over to the television set, turning it on, watching it flicker to life just in time to see an airplane crash into the World Trade Center.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I feel like there are moments in your life where you have just this unbelievable clarity, you know, and in that moment for me, in the wake of the most horrific terrorist attack in our nation's history, it was like I knew exactly what I was supposed to do with my life, you know, and it was to serve something greater than myself, join the infantry, go to airborne school, go to ranger school. I really did want to be, you know, in conventional light infantry on the front lines, taking the fight to the enemy. And, you know, I became a brand new second lieutenant in May of 2004. I was at the 10th Mountain Division, you know, and 2005 after my training, and a year and a half later, we were in Afghanistan for 485 days of combat. And it was, jeez. I mean, this was at a time back in 2005, 2006, when Afghanistan was just a stability and support operation. Yes. We were not getting in my unit any intelligence from the front, none. I mean, the eyes of this of the nation were wholeheartedly focused on what was going on in Iraq. Should we or should we not be there? Should we send, should the surge happen or not? And we weren't getting anything from the front. And so we went, and I feel like when we got to Afghanistan, man, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. We were well-trained and we were ready, but I mean, we weren't fighting, you know, farmers with pitchforks. We were fighting, you know, hardened Islamic extremists, you know, Haqqani network, Hekmati or Taliban, Al-Qaeda, whatever.
Is this the period of time that when the insurgency was really starting to ramp up in Afghanistan? Because I was there the summer of 04, 05, and honestly, it was fairly quiet.
Yep. Same, you know, most of my NCOs in my platoon, you know, and my platoon sergeant, they were there in 04 and 05 with the 10th Mountain Division, and I think that they were in Jabad in Ghazni, and they said that nothing was going on. Most of the time, they were just bored, you know? And when we ripped out with the 173rd Airborne, those were the guys that were in our base before us. We came in and they were like, you could see the look on their eyes. And these guys, 173rd, you know, for people that are listening, they're legit infantry. They're amazing.
They're airborne light infantry.
They're incredible. And they were just like, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into here. That's like not what you want to hear when you first land, you know. And we were like, okay. And I remember Ryan Kennedy, who was just one heck of an officer, was our company commander, I think he was a senior lieutenant in the company, but had been a platoon leader in Bermel District, which is where I was in Afghanistan, which is about 45 minutes north of Shkin. And our area was just to patrol that border area and close with and destroy the enemy. That was our only mission back then. I mean, and he was showing me some of the videos and of the firefights that they were in. And it was just like, no joke, a conventional infantryman's dream. So naturally, like early on, I was like really excited to see what combat would be like, you know, as an infantryman, that's what you sign up for.
You get to go do your job.
Yeah. And, you know, oh man, did we get a chance to find out? I mean, the guys that fought us in that border area, in that border region, every single firefight that we were in, we were outnumbered at least 2-1. Mm-hmm. I mean, and these guys were good. I think our first ambush that we were caught in was an L-shaped ambush. We were coming around a mountaintop. The enemy waited for us to dip down into this wadi system in this hill, knowing that our comms were line of sight. You know,
they're very Afghani, very good at this.
They're amazing. And they hit us simultaneously. They volley fired RPGs from either side of our convoy, hit my front truck, hit my lead truck, stopped them both in their place, effectively trapped us in this, like, you know, looked like what a gravy pour on Thanksgiving. We're trapped in the bottom of this bowl, just getting pounded on all sides with three PKM machine guns hitting us from each side. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, I got a year and a half of this. And so all of that, because, you know, September 11th, right? And yeah. I wanted to take the fight to the enemy. And so 485 days of combat was rough. It's hard. And ended up being medically retired thereafter.
And a lot of that is detailed in your first book, right?
Yeah. I mean, Outlaw Platoon, that's what it is. I mean, it's just a story of my soldiers. You know, like with Outlaw Platoon, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the eyes of this nation were focused on Iraq. It was funny, like my guys, you know how you go home on R&R throughout a deployment, and what they do in the conventional infantry is they look at the term of your deployment and say, okay, like first squad, pick days from, you know, say May 4th to July 2nd. And for, you know, everybody would rotate on leave that way. Guys would go home on leave and Americans would be like, oh, thank you for your service. You know, where were you deployed? And they'd be like, Afghanistan. And Americans would be like, oh gosh, you know, thank God you're not in Iraq, because it's just like so dangerous over there. My guys would come back and be like, oh my God, nobody even knows. I just got shot in the head last week. Nobody even knows what the heck is going on over there. And so I just thought to myself, I got to write this book, man. I got to make sure that their legacy is, you know, written down on the page and Americans can pick this book up 100 years from now and learn about what my guys went through over there. And that was the catalyst and the reason behind writing that story.
Kind of the boots on the ground infantry experience.
Yes.
That, you know, they tried to capture in like Oliver Stone tried to capture in Platoon or.
Yes. Yeah, for real. I mean, that's what Outlaw Platoon, there's no politics in Outlaw Platoon. It's just a warts and all story, you know? And, you know, for me, you know, I was a young lieutenant, man, and I didn't really know anything. I was so lucky to have, you know, non-commissioned officers that taught, coached, and mentored me every step of the way. They had every reason in the world to ostracize me in some office someplace and just, hey, sir, do paperwork, shut up, don't get anybody hurt, just keep your mouth closed. But they didn't, man. They didn't. I mean, these were guys that had 2 or 3 combat deployments already under their belts. I mean, their boots had more experience in the military than I did, but they just were the best. You know, my soldiers included, not just my NCOs. They just made sure that I knew what it meant to be a servant leader. And, you know, I was really, really lucky to be around them. And I thought, you know, when I was medically retired out of the military, I thought to myself, you know, that the charge of command or leadership is not something that you should relinquish, even though you hang up your uniform. It's something that's lifelong. You know, it's a leader's job to keep that sense of collective identity of a unit intact so that when they come home, they still feel like they're part of a team. You know, so many of the issues that our veterans face in this country today are because they, you know, they feel isolated when they come home. And if you think about it, like guys trained to go to war together, shoot, move, and communicate together as a team. Then you go to war and you fight, bleed, and you die together. And then you come home and everybody goes their separate ways. They either get out of the military or they go to a different duty assignment, PCS or whatever. It just runs contrary to the way that we were trained. So part of my job, I think, as a leader is to keep that sense of collective identity intact and by putting their story on the page. And that was what Outlaw Platoon was.
Yeah, I get that sense from my ODA team leader as well. He tries to like hold things together a little bit for people. He's a good guy, but last year went to a memorial for one of the guys on our team who killed himself. And while I was there, I met this other Green Beret who had been my friend's best man at his wedding and then had been his pallbearer when he died.
Oh, my God. Man.
And this guy, he was a young guy. And I found out that he died unexpectedly a week ago. And
I am so sorry to hear that.
It's just, it's the, you know, like you said, warts and all, I love the military, and I have a lot of fond memories about it, but it's like these sorts of things are the one time that I look at it and I kind of wonder, like, did I do the right thing joining the military? Because these guys are dying so young.
Well, exactly. And it's, if you look at it for like, just even from like an existential standpoint, when you go into the military and you start your training, you know, even just as a conventional infantry guy, you learn to move as a collective team. You become each other. And so when these guys come home and the journey from home, a journey back home from war begins, and it's something that has transcended culture and time. Since there's been war, men have come home from it. And so it's something that's not unique to American culture. It's something that's far deeper than that. And, you know, it's, you know, when guys come home and they lose their life and it's not in a smoking hot pile of brass. And I mean, seriously, yeah. As an infantryman, if I got to go down like that, like, so be I'm it. Ready. So yeah. be it. It's part of the job, right? And but when you come home and guys take their life and they lose that fight here at home, it just you lose a part of yourself.
Yeah.
And so Outlaw Platoon, of my guys, like, they had two deployments, lost six people total from the platoon on each of those deployments. But we've lost more people in that platoon to suicide now than we ever did in two deployments of heavy combat. I mean, is that not staggering?
It's crazy. And it, I mean, that's kind of been what my observation also. I don't know, it runs contrary. We have this sort of self-image of ourselves that we're like these big tough guys. We're America's alpha males. And there's some truth to that. But then if you look at like the 22 veterans a day statistic, like these two narratives don't make sense, because if we're really that tough, we wouldn't have this problem, right?
Right, right. And well, you think about... I've got a lot of theories and thoughts behind this, but if you think about like the way that American warriors look at themselves, regardless of what branch they served, they almost look at themselves like, you know, like the samurai looked how samurai looked at themselves. Like they don't see suicide as something that is inherently dishonorable. Like, you know, you see guys on Twitter or Facebook all the time saying, see you in Valhalla. They believe that, when they die, they're going to dine in Valhalla with their brothers that they miss. So, you know, I think that's part of the reason why, you know, veteran suicide is so high. I think a more important reason is that people in this country, you know, only 0.4% of this nation served during the longest period of war in our nation's history. And the people that enjoy freedom on a day-to-day basis are very, very far away from those who have carried a very heavy burden for a long time and those who protect freedom. Mm-hmm. And so guys come home and they feel isolated and they feel like their country doesn't really, really understand what they went through. And they end up feeling like exiles in their own country.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's such a disconnect between the two.
Yes.
You know, even a friend of mine, after we served together, he went and he worked down in Tampa at the Special Operations Command Central. And he was like, you know, Jack, the reason why this war's gone on so long is because the officers who run it, they're not in the field.
Oh, my God.
They're down in so Tampa. True. They come into work. They do PT. They run the war from 9 to 5. And then they get in their BMW and drive home.
Oh, my God. You know what? What you just said, I never even thought of it, but you're exactly right. You know, a lot of the field grade officers and above, or maybe even strategic level officers, are guys that grew up in the 90s, right? And so their formidable platoon leader time or NCO time was in the 90s when we were in large part, you know, outside Panama or whatever. I mean, like a peacetime force.
It's a far cry from like Patton, who was like outrunning his logistics lines, getting way ahead of the front. And then the rest of the army would have to catch up with him.
It's so true.
Today's leaders, military leaders, they're here. They're in the United States. They're chilling down in Tampa.
I know. God, it's so true. You know, the general officership in the army is really changed. The culture has changed from the Pattons of the world during World War II leading the charge to, you know, sitting in
Even Eisenhower wasn't necessarily on the front. Exactly. He was still over there.
No, it's so true. And, you know, these guys, like, I always liken the guys that are running the war, you know, I always liken it to being like an artist. You know, train your whole life to be a painter and you never had the opportunity to paint. Like, for example, like you're an infantryman, you train your whole life to be an infantryman. Now these guys are generals and they've never been in the fight themselves, but they're the ones running the show. And so, you know, not only do you find a disconnect in civilian society between veterans and civilians, but you find it in the military too, between the general officer leadership and the boots on the ground leaders that have been kicking in doors for 17 years. You know, the philosophy from boots on the ground guys that have been there, yeah. done that is right. It's oftentimes very different than
it's
what
totally different.
Right, am I right about
and,
that?
And it's even, you know, I've discussed it on the podcast a little bit in the past, the difference between say the infantrymen and some of the people, men and women, patriotic Americans, I want to point out, but they serve in more like logistics and sort of the background role that keeps the gears of the military greased.
Right.
And they had worked in almost a corporate environment.
For sure.
Like the mentality between, you know, the guys who are out on patrol in Afghanistan and these people who serve behind a desk, even though their jobs are really just as important to keep the military functioning, like the mentality is just so different. It's like you two different worlds.
I mean, you're totally right. Let me give you an example of what I think you're talking about. So, young platoon leader in Afghanistan, we came back from a firefight. One of my squad leaders had taken a bullet to the ankle. He was bleeding everywhere. And I was trying to help him get a tourniquet above his ankle. And I got some of his blood on my kit, right? And I go back to the base. And it was like, hey, the red ring route's coming in, man. Like, you're going on leave tomorrow, so pack your stuff and go. And I'm just like, I got 10 minutes to pack my stuff. My uniform's filthy and disgusting. And I'm flying back to Bagram, right? I got still got blood on my kit from one of my squad leaders. I get off the bird. I walk 100 yards, right? And I run into this major who had been at Bagram the entire time. And he's like, your uniform is a disgrace. You need to go change. I'm like, dude, really? Like, and I walked around Bagram for a day before I went home on leave. And I'm like, everybody that's stationed here should be paying the army.
You're a disgrace. Yeah. Well, you're a disgrace for being in combat leading troops.
Well, I mean, it's just like, it's that disconnect. Like, yeah. His mind is not even in the same headspace as mine. Like, no. People, you know, where people are, hey, what time does green bean coffee open, man? Because I want to beat the rush.
It's salsa night.
Like, yeah, I was pooping in a can for a year. There's a big difference, right? I'm serious, man. Like, yeah. And like, it, you know, Bagram is like a corporate environment. I said, you know, people that are stationed there, you know, God bless them, man. They're serving their country. They're away from their family. And I really don't mean to take anything away from their service. I don't. But it's a different thing. They should be paying the army to go there. It's like you walk around, you go to these world-class gyms, right? Seriously, they're really amazing gyms. And there are water coolers everywhere with bottled water. I'm thinking like, yeah. This is like Club Med,
yep.
You know?
In Bagram at that time, there was a Burger King. I think there was a Cinnabon by that Cinnabon. Point. yeah. There was the Thai massage parlor. Yeah. There was, what else was there? Yeah, they had salsa night and all that stuff.
They had hairstylists. In fact, one of my, my RTO, when we came back from deployment, he's like, I'm treating myself right. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm getting waxed. I'm like, you're getting waxed? He's like, yeah, I'm all my body hair. I'm like, what? Why? Why? He's like, I'm getting a Brazilian. I'm like, no, why? Why would you? But so he had the capability to get a Brazilian wax as a man coming back from combat in Bagram. I don't think I could walk down the streets of New York on this block and find somebody to give me a Brazilian. Not that I would want one, but
you'd
I'm just
surprised.
Saying,
around yeah. here, I feel like
that's where you're wrong, buddy.
But this is New York City, man. You know, like you don't. You had like an entire staff of Russian stylists and manicurists and pedicurists in Bagram.
Yeah.
And they were filled every single day.
It's bizarre. I was only in Bagram for about maybe 5 days total going from point A to point B like you. But there's the, they had like the super jock there for all like the task force guys.
And right.
The camp that all the Rangers and everyone lived in, I'm not joking. It looked like Auschwitz.
It was wired up. I know. You're exactly right. It's fenced in with triple strand concertina wire.
A lot of guys came home from that bullshit Bagram deployment on antidepressants because their lives were so miserable there.
I don't doubt it at all. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're exactly right. It does feel like that. Like you walk past the special operations complex in Bagram. I mean, it's got these chain link fences covered by like with this green
guard
stuff,
huts,
guard huts corners. Everywhere, triple strand concertina wire. And, you know, yeah, I get it. It's
and the chain of command, all those officers up there, like the guy that was chewing your ass, getting off the helicopter. That's all you have up there. And they're just like on these guys' balls the entire time.
Well, it's like, yeah, for not having their PT belt on when they walk down Disney Drive. Drive is the main drag down down the center of Bagram. But yeah, you don't wear your PT belt there. You get yelled at
because they know they're on a bullshit non-combat deployment, but they need to get their OER bullets.
Yeah.
So they're doing all kinds of stupid stuff, just making everyone's life miserable.
It's true. You know, I had an NCO tell me very early on as a young leader, like, don't be one of those officers that is concerned with only with the bow and never with their wake, right? Yeah. So like always focus on the here and now. Don't really worry about what higher tells you. I mean, always accomplish their intent, but your job is to accomplish the mission and take care of your soldiers. I mean, your job as a leader, as a platoon leader, a young platoon leader especially, is to be a bullshit filter. Make sure that your men have the space and time to train on what matters so that when they go outside the wire,
yeah,
they can focus on the mission. Like so much of our time in Afghanistan, I mean, as a leader, my platoon sergeant and I would just go down the list and be like, don't need to bother the guys with this. Don't need to bother the guys with this either. And so, yeah, you get your ass chewed for that by your company commander if something doesn't get done, but it's worth it because your soldiers are able to focus on what they're supposed to focus on.
As much as BS as I thought I had to deal with as a sergeant or a staff sergeant, I realize in retrospect I'm quite infantile in some ways, and that I had officers who were protecting me from the vast majority of the bullshit.
Yeah, it's crazy. I hated, and I loved being a platoon leader. I think it's the best job in the Army. It really is for an officer, because you have direct contact with your troops every single day. But my least favorite part of being a platoon leader was like these battlefield update briefs, and so like you'd go in and like all my NCOs would be like laughing at me because they'd be out there like smoking cigarettes or cigars
and you haven't slept in 3 days.
We'd get back off of a mission and I'd have to go be the battle captain in the talk for a 12-hour shift at night. I'd be like to my commander, I'm like, sir, like any one of these other officers here that don't do 24-hour operations, could they maybe take the midnight shift in the talk? This made sense, right? Of course not. No, of course. We want to put the guys that are out there fighting and getting shot at every day in the talk overnight. So it's like, yeah, it's a lot of that garbage that sort of makes you pull your hair out like when you serve. And that's the stuff that you don't miss. But I think generally speaking, if I had to look at the entirety of my service, I do miss it. I think I would go back in a second,
There are definitely aspects of it that I miss. But I mean, I think for both of us, we probably came in at quite the right time.
I think so too.
And honestly, I'll be quite honest, though, I think I got out at the right time too.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't my call to get out, although I think I was on my way. After I came back, I mean, I had aspirations to be like a career Army guy when I went in. And after I experienced a year, like 485 days of combat, I'm like, okay, I've had my fill. I'm done,
Well, it's also going to be pretty hard for you to come down off of that and, do the staff positions. And
exactly.
Even though you checked the block, you got your CIB, but I think it would be difficult. I think it would, at least for me, I think it would be difficult to transition over to that.
Absolutely. When I got back, they made me an XO, and then I was a company commander for a while prior to even having gone to the command course, and it was just not the same.
Yeah.
And honestly, like if you wanted to have a wife and kids and a family, like the 10th Mountain Division at that time was going back in 9 months. Like, so we get this, we get back from a year and a half. So, okay. So people need to know we were extended a day before we were supposed to go home. Me and my platoon sergeant were the last people from my platoon left on the base. We were for doing the rip with the 82nd Airborne coming in to replace us. I had guys in Bagram. I had guys that were already home, and we get a call. SecDef had gotten a call from our SecDef had called our commander, it was General Frakely at the time, and we got extended like within 24 hours. We get called to the talk like at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's never a good call. And we're like, oh god, somebody's getting attacked somewhere. We're gonna have to roll outside the wire and respond. But no, it was like 287 infantry has been extended for 120 days or until mission complete. Those are the last when you're in the infantry and you're surrounded by the Joe Mafia, who are also like barracks attorneys. Yeah, they focus in on those words or until mission complete. And it was a day before we were supposed to come home. And so we had MPs that were going to my soldiers' houses and taking them out of their homes and walking them back to the RDF, the Rapid Deployment Facility. Holy and putting them shit. Back on the birds and flying them back to Afghanistan. And then we were there for another 4 months, a whole another spring offensive. So it was miserable. That was my deployment.
Wow.
And again, this is like one of those moments where I don't really know where I was going with that, but
I'll tell you what that moment is. That's the moment where you're like, thank God I'm not married and I don't have kids, because imagine them going through all that.
Yeah. So the Army had spent tens of thousands of dollars sending psychologists and all this other stuff. Families had already booked vacations and made down payments on apartments and houses and bought houses and started school and all this other stuff. And man, it was a shitstorm. It really was. I've never seen men so dejected as they were getting off that bird back in Bermel. And no joke, they had us outside the wire that same day.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's just like, you know, it was the whole mentality of like, you know, you fall off a bike, you know, get back on the bike and keep riding as soon as possible, except for people are trying to kill you and shooting at you. So it's a little bit different. You know, it was a leadership challenge, to say the least.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really bad.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, to put it mildly. Guys were really dejected.
Pretty demoralized after that.
Yeah, you know, because the army of today is really different than, you know, say the Spartans. You know, back then, you were responsible for how capable you were as a warrior. You had your own sword, you had your own shield, and it was your job to maintain it, and it was your job to bring your own food, it was your job to do all that stuff. It's not so in the military, in the army of today. They provide you your armor, they provide you your weapon, they provide you your training, they provide you your money, they give you a place to live. I mean, it's like they give you your water. They're almost like a parent figure to you. So when we were extended the day prior to going home, somebody, you know, we thought to ourselves, somebody up in the higher echelons of command had to have known a long time ago. Even a week would have made a big difference. You know, we were extended a day before I was supposed
and
to go home.
They waited up until
and
the
they
very
waited
last moment.
The last moment to do it. So it was almost like when they did that, the army had betrayed us. You know, like it was like being betrayed by a parent, and that I think was more traumatic for my soldiers than any combat that we were in.
Yeah, because now you have to ask yourself the question, like, who is making these decisions?
Exactly.
And why are they making them?
Yeah, so what had happened was, is we had built Combat Outpost Margah. That was the very first combat outpost that was built in Afghanistan during the shift in strategy, right? To where, you know, we built all these combat outposts, and we were going to have a presence in every village, just like we did in Iraq, and we were going to win the hearts and minds. It's a strategy that in Afghanistan just doesn't work. So we built this combat outpost, and I was up there manning it. And, you know, I remember the engineers had left in the middle of the night because we were the area that we were in was so dangerous. They just up and left. So we had these half-filled HESCO walls around a combat outpost that we just couldn't fill because the engineers were like, "Oh, sorry, this wasn't in the job description. This place is too dangerous. We're out." And they left us in the middle of the night.
That's crazy.
And not joking, man. This was a wild, wild west time in the army.
These are also American soldiers, yeah, you should point out.
Yes. And so there we were, sitting with five gun trucks in my truck in the middle, and I had to drive up my gun trucks on these ramps that the engineers were using to fill these HESCO walls and put gun trucks up on the ramp so I could have 4 points of security. And that night, I get a call at like 3 a.m. from my boss, you know, from my company commander. We had Predator in the sky who he had seen. He said, "Hey, you know, I don't want to alarm you, but from your east, you have 250 enemy fighters moving in on your position. And from your north, you've got another 55. And I'm like, "What?" And so my platoon sergeant comes over to me. He's like batting down the hatches. And we got ready for this fight. But thank God we had Predator in the air. But our battalion commander ended up, well, he was amazing. He's like a modern day Patton, really. He was so great. I stacked up all this air from we had Predator in the sky, and then we had Apaches, and then, you know, we had, you know, Warthogs, and then we had B-1 Strategic Lancers in the air. And like, so he did a great job deconflicting all that air. And I mean, we started with dropping 3 or 4 2,000-pound JDAMs on them. And it's funny because we can listen to their commo, and they know that. That's why they have their own comsec and stuff, you know. They're like, the last thing they said before we dropped those munitions, they were like, "Overrun the platoon. Make sure you cut off their heads." And it was just like, we dropped the bombs on them right after that. And I have the Predator feed from that fight. I have the Predator feed of just watching these bombs hit, and then these guys scatter. And then I think our base called in 250 rounds of 105 artillery. That was just, you see like the explosions on the thermals from the Pred. And then we had A-10 coming in and Apaches coming in. It was just like, it was amazing. And by the time we got to that objective the next day, it was an infantryman's dream, right? We were just kicking boots.
Yeah,
everybody was dead. You know,
that's a pretty actually a pretty good day as far as like the enemy massing their forces like that. Like, how often do you have the opportunity to wipe out 300 of them at once?
I know, and people don't believe me until I show them the video. I have the Predator video, and they were moving in a tactical column. And the Pred would just follow this trail, and it looked for like 2 minutes would just follow these guys. And you can just count them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, all the way back to the border. They were marching in to hit us. And so my point with telling you all that is that the SecDef came down for that because we found PAC-MIL ID cards, Frontier ID cards on them. So PAC-MIL was supporting that attack. And we gave that all that intel to the SecDef, and the SecDef took it and went back to the Pentagon. And 2 weeks later, we were extended because they had sent all of the units that were meant to replace us to Iraq, and we were just left there, you know?
How, what was the mix at that time, like Afghan, or from what you're saying, somewhere Pakistani, versus like foreign fighters from the Gulf states and so forth?
Well, so in that particular engagement, you know, it felt like PACMIL because when we did the sensitive site exploitation, what you call like the SSE on the objective, they were wearing plate carriers, body armors. I mean, they had Merrill combat boots. A lot of the equipment that they had was right. I mean, the PKMs and AK-47s that they had, they were right off there. I mean, we weren't allowed to talk about this at the time, but Iranian serial numbers fresh off the assembly lines in Iran. I mean, they were well equipped.
Do you think they were freelance doing a mercenary?
That's a really interesting question. I had never thought about it until now. Maybe
entrepreneurial minded, guy, because in parts of Pakistan, like the Fatah and Baluchistan and places, yeah, like that, I mean, they have a real history of working freelance.
You're right. Yeah, it's an interesting question I'd never thought about until now, maybe, because they were really, really well equipped. And so, you know, we had an interesting cross-section of enemy, though, to answer your question. Like, that was actually one of our greatest challenges, just trying to figure out who we were fighting that given day. Is this Haqqani? Is this Ahmadiyya? Or is this just, like, a drug deal gone wrong? Or is this Taliban?
Right.
Al-Qaeda? We had no idea. So, I mean, there were times where, I mean, we fought, I mean, obviously, you know, jihadists that spoke Pashto and specifically Waziri in that area, which is interesting because we had to have local Terps from that area that could speak Waziri because the Terps that the army were sending us couldn't speak Waziri.
Is that what they speak closer to the Iranian border?
In RC East. It was the Pakistan border, RC East, Shkin area from basically Fob Tilman on down, all spoke Waziri. Everywhere else around there spoke Farsi and Pashto, but the Terps that we had to be from that local area because it was such an obscure dialect. We didn't have anybody that could do it. So the enemy that we fought there was just, I mean, they were a little from column A, a little from column B. We had a real difficult time identifying who they even were half the time, but they seemed to all be crammed in there.
I mean, they might have all been fighting different factions fighting for that turf
absolutely
at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, it wasn't even like, you know, like you said, like sometimes you just like get in the middle of a drug deal or something,
yeah,
you know, you know, somebody like, you know, and they just shoot at you for whatever reason. It was real hard to identify who the enemy was. I mean,
I remember an operation, down in the Pakistan border we did one time and, you know, we were driving through the mountains and everything, and you could hear firefights down in the valley, just gunfire, mortar fire. I mean, mixing it up pretty good. And, you know, we'd ask the Afghan border control people, you know, who are they coming for us? What is this? What's going on? And they're like, nah, it's just two rival families duking it out. You know, yeah, has nothing to do with you.
Exactly. Exactly, man. And like, it was really challenging. I remember one engagement. We were down in Shkin. Shkin is like, in our regional command east, right on the border. I mean, like it's a stone's throw away from the pack mill that are manning the other border checkpoint on the other side. And they had Dishkas mounted on all these. I mean, they're all aimed right at this place called the Alamo. And the Alamo is like removed from Firebase Shkin, but it was all the way on the border. And we had a mission there once. And we just got attacked. It was like the worst kind of attack too, because it was indirect fire. Like they were hitting us with mortars and rockets, and we really couldn't see where they were coming from. So we also couldn't shoot back because they were using the pack mill as like basically as like human shields, knowing that if we fired at the pack mill, like it would create an international incident. So all we could do is hunker down and just get slammed with 107 millimeter rockets for about an hour and a half. And I learned after that engagement that was the 4th of July. I'm like, gives a whole new definition to fireworks, you know? But that's the enemy that we fought, man. They knew what they were doing, and they understood the geopolitics of the region, and they knew that if we shot and fired back at PACMIL, it would create a shitstorm.
Yeah, Pakistan, I mean, is like the puzzle, the conundrum of that entire conflict that we've been unable to unravel. It was interesting to see that they recently cut, what, $300 million of funding to the Pakistani government.
Yeah. You know, I understand the complexity of that aid package for sure, but I am a fan of the move because, you know, they're just not our friends.
No, they're not.
You know, they're frenemies, right? But, like, you know, I understanding that part of that aid package goes to physical security of their nuclear weapons,
yes,
which is really important. What always struck me in Pakistan was how everything in that country is just just perilously balanced on a knife's edge, man. Like, I don't understand how the Pakistani Taliban has not overrun, you know, a PAC mil nuke facility, or, you know, have some PAC mil officer that was corrupt, like, give somebody access. I mean, I can't believe it hasn't happened.
Really, really tight leash on that stuff. And, you know, like you said, we have some involvement in that too. There's an interesting article years ago now, I think it was in the New Yorker, and about, they published this article about Pakistani nuclear security. And one of the things the PACs were doing was driving nuclear weapons around the country in trucks, like unmarked civilian vehicles, to try, because they were so afraid that, like, you know, the JSOC dudes are going to come in the night and take control of their nuclear weapons and a sort of like decapitation strike. the way I would interpret that article though, it was probably our government, the CIA or whoever, trying to telegraph to the Pakistanis, like, hey, you need to stop driving these bombs around in trucks because it's not safe.
I know. Right. I mean, and so part of it's like part of like the plot in Man of War is you try to ask yourself, like, what's the scariest thing that could happen? Mm-hmm. And having come back from Afghanistan, it was just like a man portable nuclear weapon, like, being unleashed. It's like trying to find a needle in a stack of needles. Like, how do you track it? How do you find it? You know, I think the Russians had, in the research that I did for this book, had something like 60 some backpack portable 60 pound suitcase nukes they're man portable. They've only ever accounted for 57. Like, where are the other three?
I take it you did some research on Greenlight.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, yeah, but is it not scary? Does it not scare you?
Yeah. It's very interesting. I did a bunch of research on that on our program with the man portable nuclear weapons, and of all the special forces guys I talked to who are on Greenlight, I don't think any of them actually even saw a live nuclear weapon.
Now,
they had simulators and they had inspections, and there were points of inspection. They had to come in and take the weapon apart, put it back together, arm it, disarm it. It was all on a training simulator. And if you failed inspection, God help you, if you failed an inspection, the team leaders were relieved immediately.
No, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it was a very elite thing. They called them pig teams, which was Palmer's Imperial Guards, after the general who came up with the program or was a big part of the program.
Yeah.
So pig teams. And the Greenlight guys did interesting stuff. That's where the Rolex watches that SF guys have, it's because they gave those Rolex watches to Greenlight teams because they were going to have to parachute with these nuclear weapons behind enemy lines, and they might have to use the Rolex as a barter item.
Yes, that is what I know of the Greenlight teams. Like, all the stuff about disarming the nuclear weapons and relieving the team, I had no idea. But that's why I have Rolex Submariner. Eric Steele in my book wears a Rolex Submariner for that very reason, in case he has to barter. Yes, he uses a barter.
I have to stress, this is a rumor, but guys who were on the teams, they told me, so they would activate, there's an actual like keypad on the weapon to arm it, and then they would have something like 35-45 minutes to vacate the area before the weapon detonates.
Oh man, that's cool. I'm sorry, but that's pretty cool.
These are baby nukes, so
yeah, TAC nukes or something.
You could get away, you could probably get escape the blast radius. But the scuttlebutt internally on the teams was that the second they put the code into the weapon, was going to detonate and blow up in their faces, kill the team.
Oh my God.
Because they'd be like, look, it's a suicide mission from the get go. So the idea was like, you know, the scuttlebutt was that it was to sacrifice the team. So what they did in training with the simulator is they'd have just two guys go up to the final point with the bomb and activate it while the rest of the team was in an overwatch position.
Because they
came to believe in their mind that that weapon was going to go off the second they armed it.
That is intense. That is crazy. Yeah. That is crazy, man. I mean, that is, to me, that's the nightmare scenario. Well, I just find it just...
Tell us more about the book then. I want you to tell us how you transitioned into writing a novel.
Yeah, nonfiction to fiction is a tough jump.
And a long gap of time in between. Yeah. You and I were talking before we were recording, and your first book came out, as you were saying, around the time of American Sniper,
yes.
Lone Survivor. those are all books we remember from 5+ years ago.
Yes.
And now you write a fiction novel.
Yeah, Outlaw Platoon came out in like February of 2012. American Sniper came out in January of 2012. I actually met Chris after our books had published and became friends with him after that. But yeah, I think part of the problem is that it just takes a long time to learn how to tell a good story. And, you know, I say this all the time, but if you're an aspiring fiction writer, it's far more important to be a good storyteller than it is to be a good writer. I mean, you have to be able to write. I mean, but there are a lot of great people, great writers out there who can write a great op-ed too, but could not pull off writing a fiction story. And that's precisely because they don't know how to tell a story. And so for 6 years, I just did research and read books and watched films and just try to get a sense of, you know, what's the best way to have a story dramatically unfold, and the idea of showing the reader something as opposed to simply telling them. The learning curve was steep. I think I wrote and rewrote in, you know, a different Eric Steele story. It took me 4 years to actually get it done and get that book published because I had to start from scratch 3 or 4 times because I just didn't have.
You weren't feeling it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. And so Man of War is a, it's a character driven book. It's obviously plot driven. I think it's a nice hybrid between a plot driven and character driven story. And what I mean by that is that, you know, I think it's important specifically for thrillers to have your protagonist or hero, or in this case, Eric Steele in Man of War, drive the plot.
And I should throw out there, Eric Steele is a Green Beret.
Former Green Beret,
or former Army Ranger, and infantry officer.
Yeah, infantry officer, Ranger qualified guy. Like, I was never in a Ranger battalion like Jack, right? You were in a Ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a difference that many people don't understand, but I think
my mom is still confused about the difference
don't
between
get
Ranger
it,
school and Ranger battalion.
They don't get it because it is so confusing, not to divert from the conversation, but there are guys in Ranger battalions that don't have a Ranger tab. But guys in Ranger battalions are Rangers, and then there are guys in conventional infantry units that have Ranger tabs.
We kind of screwed up on the PR side of explaining that to the public.
Yeah, yeah, and people don't get it, and that's fine. It's neither here nor there. But you know, I tried to write this book and make it as authentic, bring the lessons that I learned from combat and make the engagements as authentic as humanly possible. But it was a steep learning curve, you know, and I thought the most important part is having characters that are rich and believable with depth, that have both internal and external conflicts and their own specific and personal psychology. Like, that's the checklist for characters. And they have to have depth. People have to feel like they're real, like Eric Steele and Demo, his keeper, and Meg and Rockford, who is the president. They feel like real people to me, you know, after having worked in developing their characters for 4 years and their own idiosyncrasies and stuff. It's a monumental challenge to do it and do it right. Now, there are people out there that can just write a fiction book because they have it, right? They just get it. You know, I'm not one of those people. But, you know, Man of War, like, I thought to myself when writing this book, like, there were several times where there were missions where, like, we knew where a high-value target was. Like, he's like right over in that compound. He sets up a lemonade stand every Tuesday. We know he goes to the market and shaves on Thursday. Can we just go get him? No. Well, why can't we have to wait for so-and-so's approval at the Pentagon? Well, that become a week later and the guy's already gone. Yeah. It's like we're shooting ourselves in the foot with this war. So I just thought to myself, like, you know, I need to develop my own clandestine unit. You know, so much of these books that have a guy working for the CIA or a part of some DOD organization or some black ops unit. Like, I created my own unit. It's called the Alpha Program. And there are 9 alphas, each responsible for a different geographic area of the globe, all of whom report directly to the president. So in order to give the president operational flexibility. So if the president can't handle a mission with diplomacy or boots on the ground, special operations or war, all out war, he sends in an alpha to handle the situation, and they're just expected to handle it, whether it's a targeted assassination mission or something that's more diplomatic. So Eric Steele is a former Green Beret, as you mentioned. He cut his teeth in Afghanistan, was put in for the Medal of Honor, but then just got what's called a notification from the Alpha program to come and try out. And the trial, they call it NDOC, but it's at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, at a place called the Salt Pit. I mean, I just created all this from scratch, but there's 4 phases to NDOC, and he goes through the 4 phases of the Alpha training program and becomes the youngest and most talented Alpha in the history of the Alpha program. and the Alpha program itself was in the books anyway, was developed in the wake of World War II, refined during the Cold War and the rise of Stalin in post-World War II era to combat the Russians in Europe, and was steadily developed and refined, and now, you know, at its peak in the global war on terror. So the book starts in a way, in a method of storytelling called in media res. So
in the middle of it.
Yeah. Right. And so Eric Steele was thrown into a club in Beirut called the Dragon's Door. It's a real club. And he's like, he knows something's wrong. He gets a CIA target package. It just feels too convenient to him. And he's just thrown into it and expected to figure it out. And so with Man of War, like, just, you know, I love mentor turned enemy type stories, you know? And so the story centers around him. I don't want to give it away, but you know, his former alpha trainer mentor, who was thought dead. He was sort of has a Benghazi type feel to the story. Like, there's a guy that was, you know, assassinated. They didn't send in any help for him. They knew the attack was coming and they just sort of like let him die, he doesn't die.
Brody.
Yeah. Right. So he doesn't die. And so, but Eric doesn't know this. I mean, the reader knows this. You'll read about Nathaniel West on chapter two, but Eric doesn't know this. And so there's some, you know, I feel like that gives a little bit of tension. Anytime there's a mentor turned enemy sort of in a story, it feels a lot more personal.
The dude, yeah.
Yeah.
So one of our own going to the other side is just something that scares people.
And you know, it's not even like for Nathaniel West, like the other side, meaning like he's in it for himself. Right. Like Nathaniel West's goal, like he doesn't give a crap about Islamic extremists. In fact, he hates them just as much as you know, as much as we do. But like, you know, he's in it for himself because he knows he was betrayed by high level people in the U.S. government. And he's going after those people. And it's up to Eric to stop them.
As far as like what you describe with the Alpha program, it's kind of that you know, created for this book. It's interesting because a lot of people, like, we talk about like, oh, there's like tier two, tier one, all this kind of stuff. But there's like, people don't understand, there's like these little levels that are sort of above that.
Yes.
That, like, if
exactly.
You're in JSOC or something like that, and they're watching you and seeing what you do and cultivating people. And if they like what you're doing, it's possible that you get absorbed into some sort of compartmentalized program.
You're exactly right.
And there are guys who maybe were an operator at one point, and now they're working for some program, and one day they could have credentials as a FBI agent. The next day they could have credentials as this a border control guy.
Yeah, this is right.
Yep. It's called official cover.
Yeah.
And that it's not so that they can go around and make arrests. It's just so that they can get to where they need to be to gather intelligence.
Exactly. And that's in this book. Like, Eric Steele has official cover for Europe and different geographic areas of the globe. Like, he has an alias and he has a business.
Or like, you can be like a German military officer.
Yep. That's all in this. That's all in this book, you know, because I feel like people that pick up these books, like, expect a certain amount of like knowledge about the military and tradecraft and stuff like that. But you're right. I mean, we had some guy in Afghanistan. Again, it was just a young conventional infantry guy. I mean, he was a full colonel. His name is Colonel Biddle. I mean, I think. And he just came on patrol with us one day, and he was his own guy, and we're doing patrols in the middle of the night. And he's like, I got to step out. And I'm like, what? Like, where are you going? He just leaves the wire. Like, we're out of the wire, leaves our patrol base by himself. Have no idea where he goes. The next day, you know, he was gone, and the local elders from that village were like, hey, something happened last night. Like, so-and-so disappeared. And I'm just like, Colonel Biddle. But this is just like a full bird colonel, just a singleton operator doing his own thing. He said he was a special forces guy. I mean, but like,
that stuff happens. The way that comes together is it's like an offline conversation that happens between some spooky guy and some company commander. Oh, you're going on an operation in this area? Hey, I got this guy. He's a DIA contractor.
Right.
He's going to go along with you. And then, yeah, the dude, like, you're out on patrol, and the guy goes off, and he's like, oh, I got to go have a meeting. I'll see you in a
That happened. It's exactly how it went down. I mean,
it's cool that you guys have experienced this, and then you get to write about it. Because, you know, we were talking earlier before we recorded about Brad Thor, and the thing about Brad Thor is, you know, he's a civilian, so he'll check with guys in the community, hey, is this legit? Would this really happen? Would the dialogue really sound like this? For you guys, you've experienced it, and so now when you get to write about this type of thing, you lived it. I think that's cool.
Brad Thor is a huge inspiration to my writing style. I think he's an amazing storyteller, and you're absolutely right, though. you know, I think this harkens to something that's really important to me, and that's veterans getting involved in the national discourse, whether it's in the media or with mainstream storytelling. Yeah. It's so important because every time a veteran steps up and decides to talk about something, their story in the war, which it's just so important. It brings civilians a little bit closer to our world. And I think that just makes this country a better place. And ultimately it makes the country a better place for veterans to live. And so for me, you know, I mean, most of what I've done since I've been out, and Outlaw Platoon gave me an amazing platform to help veterans. And I've got a national nonprofit called the American Warrior Initiative. So much of what we do is give service dogs to veterans because they just
that's awesome.
they help vets a lot, man. Yeah. The wait list is like 10 years and some of these dogs cost $25,000. Well, we cut through all that, wow, fund the dogs and get vets off of wait list. And so that's what I've done. But I also started realizing, having watched some of these movies that we have and TV shows coming out, like, veterans, people that have been there and done that, need to start writing more mainstream stories. Because I grew up watching like Back to the Future and Indiana Jones, and yeah, I like love, dude, Back to the Future is one of my favorite movies. I'm like, I love Marty McFly. I love me some Indiana Jones.
Hello, McFly.
Yeah, exactly. So, but here's the deal. Who is this generation's Marty McFly or Indiana Jones? We keep rebooting the same things that have worked, right? And so it's our job. I see it as our personal mission to come up with mainstream characters that our young people can aspire to be like. Like, I wanted to be Indiana Jones. Yeah, you know,
I want to punch Nazis too. Yeah.
Who doesn't want to punch Nazis, man? Exactly. So I'm not saying Eric Steele is going to be that guy, but I hope he is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so that's the motivation, right? That's the goal.
You know, I'm in the midst of finishing the manuscript for my own memoir. And
that's what you were saying.
Yeah, you guys have gone the opposite direction. Yeah, he did the nonfiction first.
Because I didn't want to write my own story. And you know what? Kind of like when I started writing it and I sat down in the approach to it, you know what really inspired me was interviewing on this podcast Jocko Willink.
Dude, he's amazing.
And Chris Peronto.
Yeah, that guy's amazing. Jocko and Chris are both awesome.
And both of those guys, like, they drop like the honesty card, like, bam, like right on the table. And like, after seeing that, I was like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I feel like I have an obligation to at least be as honest as these guys have been and been as forthcoming with it. And so the book is pretty open kimono, and
that's great.
I think it's going to upset some people.
That's okay. Because of that, you know what? Look, Colonel Hackworth, man, like, he was prolific in the wake of Vietnam, but his voice was unbelievably important, and in many ways shaped the way that our military has grown and operated since. So you have, look, I can't stand reading World War II accounts from generals that feel like war is sterile, like pieces on a chessboard. Yeah. That is not what it's like. And so when I worked on writing Outlaw Platoon, it had to be a warts and all story, because if you don't write a warts and all story, and again, filled with my mistakes as a young leader, looking back in hindsight, right? You don't have the benefit of hindsight when you're living it. But now I do. If it's not a warts and all story, you're doing the American people a disservice. And everybody that dons that uniform and generations that follow, you know, are walking into a military that's going to be less capable because you didn't open your mouth and talk about things.
And I think that young kid who's like 17, 18, wants to join the military, and he's reading your book or one day my book, like, they need to know about this stuff.
They do.
So they can avoid, I mean, and I feel the same way. I hope that they can read about the mistakes I made and avoid some of that.
Absolutely. Look, it's so important. And like, you know, we're in a really tough time, right? It's a really tough time for veterans. And that's because, like I've said a couple times, veterans are real far away from civilians in this country, you know? But it happened because a very small percentage of people serve. Veterans tend to not talk about their experience. Civilians, while appreciative, don't want to ask because they don't want to dredge up something that's potentially like hurtful or something, dredge up painful memories. So as the percentage of veterans that have served has gone down, and the gap has gotten wider because there's no dialogue going on, the way that you fill that gap is by writing and telling your story. And so civilians read it, and then not only do they help you bear that burden, I mean, you think about it, you take the story out of yourself and you put it on a page. It's no longer in you. People read it and they help you bear the burden, and then they ask you questions about it, and it facilitates dialogue, and it brings people closer to veterans, and it helps heal the rift that is in this country. And
well
so,
said, man. Yeah.
And so that's why it's important for guys like you, man, like door kickers, to tell your story. And so I'm there with you. It's an important mission.
It's also important historically because, I mean, historians are going to be able to pick up Outlaw Platoon and examine that. And this is decades from now, they're going to be able to go look at declassified documents, declassified predator feed
Absolutely.
Footage, and they're going to be able to put it all together in a way that hasn't been done in wars in the past. So they'll have the first person account, they'll have the documents, they'll have the video.
Exactly. So it's an important way to recount the war. This is our longest war, and because of that, it's important for vets to get out there and tell their story, whether it's nonfiction or fiction.
By the way, I got to give some major props to William Morrow, HarperCollins, the publisher. Jack knows this. This is just funny. So when the book was sent to us, they sent us the book, which is out today.
Yes.
Man of War. Pick it up. Eric Steele awesome. Novel, the first book. But they also sent us this, which was this dossier. And I remember Jack saw this, and you were like, dude, I need something like this.
Yes. Yeah, they look back at that. She is the genius. Danielle Bartlett is a publicist extraordinaire.
So if Jack's memoir has something like this, he copied it from you. Yeah, I'll be the first to say.
It's so important.
I looked at it, I was like, what the?
I remember you just really dug that.
It's smart because you guys get how many books? It's like you need something that like
sets it apart.
And you flip through it and you get like the cliff notes for exactly. So that's all her and nothing to do with me.
Very cool. Yeah, no, I know right when you saw it, it caught your eye because it is true. We get sent dozens of books. And this stands out as opposed to one little piece of paper that says like, you know, and then on top of that, you have the quote from Lee Child on the front of the book. And that speaks volumes.
I mean, for whatever reason that he gave me he sells a book every 15 seconds. And so I'm not joking. That's true. Like he's ridiculous. He's prolific. He's been writing since the mid 90s. I was reading him when I was still in junior high. He is the king of this genre. And like to get a blurb from him has been like just amazing.
That must have been so cool.
He's amazing. He's just an amazing guy. Great. Yeah. And I got to sign books next to him at Thriller Fest this year.
Nice.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome, right? I mean, it's a dream. I don't know if this book's going to do well. I hope it does. But I got to sign books next to Lee Child, so that was cool.
I definitely think it will, because I think that people are excited to read something completely different from you, which is what this is. Totally different style of book. And the first book did tremendously. So
check out
Man of War, out today. You know, this is going up on Friday, but out this week, officialseanparnell.com, which I was looking at the website, also has a link to the charity, which you were speaking about for people who want to donate, at Sean Parnell USA on Twitter, at official Sean Parnell on Instagram. I do want to mention what we have going on at, Hurricane Media, of course, before we wrap this up. So be sure to check out Crate Club. We have an exclusive collaboration watch on the horizon that we did with NFW Watches. One of the next big items coming soon in the premium crate. We have different tiers of membership, as many of you know, depending on how prepared you want to be. Gift options are available as well. Scott Whitner from the Loadout Room and the guys are currently working on bringing you 100% custom products in 2019. Everything from sunglass cases to EDC bags and other manly products. It's a club for men, by men. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us for you dog owners. Check this out. You're going to love this. We've just partnered with Kuna. They have a team of trained canine handlers picking out a box for your dog every month of healthy treats and training aids. It's custom built for your dog's size and age as well. The products are U.S. sourced, all natural, and they not only promote a healthy diet, but also promote being active with your dog. So no matter what size dog you have, this is just what you're looking for. You can see all of that at kuna.dog. That's kuna.dog. It's efficient for you. Your dog will appreciate it as well, of course. And that's spelled CUNA.DOG. Also, as a reminder for those listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel. That's our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel. That's at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. That's only $4.99 a month. Appreciate you coming in, man. I know it's a super busy day for you today. You did Fox and Friends this morning.
Yeah. It's cool, though, man. Like, I've been wanting to do this podcast for a long time. I've known Brandon since SoftRep was in its infancy, so it's amazing to see this grow and you know, it's kind of, I'm kind of geeking out actually getting to meet Jack and do this podcast and stuff. It's kind of cool. So thank you for having me.
No, really appreciate it. And as I was saying, like, it's funny, you guys never like overlapped in service, but you know, it's cool that your first time meeting each other because you're you're approximately the same age. All of us are in our 30s. So I figured at some point you may have met each other, but I guess not.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, this has been a cool one, man. And I really think people are going to appreciate the book. You know, as I was saying to you when you came in here, there definitely is just an abundance of veteran books on the market right now. But I think that this has something that sets itself apart from everything else out there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I hope it resonates with people for sure.
Yeah. I mean, when somebody like you jumps in there and tries to or does write a book like this, I think you just bring something different to the table. It's just a gritty nature of it. You know, I was watching this movie with my daughter last night, actually, and these people were like running through the woods and everything like that. And they're like, women are wearing like perfect makeup and they all look like totally done up. I was like, anybody who's actually done something like this would know you're going to be covered in sweat and you're going to be dirty.
Exactly. Exactly. Even though I have worn makeup in the field. I'm not joking. That's cool. That's
a little
that's
rouge. A
I couldn't even get through that sentence without laughing. So.
Well, it's officialseanparnell.com at SeanParnellUSA on Twitter, at @officialSeanParnell on Instagram. It's been great, man. Thanks for taking the trip in. We really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.